The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to the Home Show podcast. My name is Sinead Ryan, and this week we are looking at whether you're a tenant or a landlord. The new rules on letting since the 1st of March are going to affect everyone in the marketplace. We have the Residential Tenancies Board in to answer your questions. The last in our series on architecture through the ages brings us right into the 20th century with Roisin Murphy. A new series of DIY masterclasses coming to a store near you, and Paul Kinsler on his experience of using an AI interior designer for his garden makeover. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the Home Show podcast, you can do that at any stage during the week by email. We're at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me on Instagram and on X, SineadRyan100. And of course, we do love to hear from podcast listeners on either of those fora. I'm usually around, happy to answer questions or take advice on what guests or topics you'd like to have on. This is your podcast. It is The Home Show, and you're very welcome. Now, new rules around renting, tenancies and landlords came into effect at the beginning of this month, ostensibly to protect renters for up to 6 years. It has drawn criticism from other quarters about whether it would simply lead to an increase in rents or more landlords leaving the market. Well, here to tell us what's actually involved is the CEO of the Residential Tenancies Board, Rosemary Steen, and its Senior Research and Policy Manager, Brian Galway. You're both very welcome to the Home Show. Studio, back to the Home Show studio. In your case, Rosemary, you've been here before because this is a story that seems to go round and round the houses, literally and figuratively, every so often. These are punchy new rules to an existing act. Tell us what's new for tenants first and then for landlords.
So thank you for having me back, Sinead. I appreciate it. I suppose just in terms of what the new changes, this is one of the most fundamental changes in rental law in 20 years. So the first thing, if you're a tenant, you have to ask yourself is, when did my lease start? Was it before the 1st of March 2026? In that case, there's actually very little change for you under these new rules. They won't, unfortunately, benefit from a new 6-year minimum tenancy cycle. All landlords can still end those tenancies anytime on the 6 grounds that were allowed before this date. That's for example, non-payment of rent or the property no longer meets the tenant needs.
And they're tight enough rules anyway, aren't
they?
So that
rules.
Hasn't changed.
And in those cases, if a tenant believes that those rules have not been applied correctly, they can bring a dispute to the RTB.
Right.
So it's very tightly overseen. And there will be no difference in tenancies before the 1st of March, whether the landlord is large or small. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
The same rules still apply. The rent increases continue to be capped at 2% or inflation, whichever is lower, and the landlord will not be able to reset market rent as long as the tenancy continues.
Grant.
But one of the things that was important and that I want to emphasise is that existing tenants are now protected from economic evictions. And that was one of the changes under the new rules.
So what does that mean now, economic eviction?
So basically, if a tenancy ends through a no-fault eviction, so for example, the tenant hasn't stopped paying rent, there isn't, one of the 6 grounds that applies, the landlord cannot reset to market rent for the next tenancy. And that's very important. The landlord in that case is not allowed reset rent. They must return to the rent that they had with that tenant.
Because the suspicion might be that some landlords might find a route to offer a notice of termination with the express intention of saying, I'll get John out so I can rent to Mary at a higher price.
And that's why the team and the RTB have been working so hard over the last couple of weeks on a public information campaign, and we've briefed 5,000 property professionals and landlords and other stakeholders. So there's really no
excuse knows about this.
For people not to know what rules apply.
Okay, so from the 1st of March, for tenancy starting this month, for the first time, let's say, what difference now do they enjoy?
So they benefit from new, stronger tenant protections. So basically, they now get a minimum 6-year tenancy cycle known as a tenancy of minimum duration. And after the first 6 months of that tenancy, the landlord can only end the tenancy for very limited reasons. And the reasons are different depending on how many tenancies a landlord has. So that's a very big change.
So we're into now the difference here, which we'll cover briefly, between what's considered a small landlord, and I suppose we'd have called those the mom and pop, the amateur landlords, and a large landlord. Mm-hmm. So what's the strict definition? The large landlords presumably are all those big funds and pensions that own big blocks of apartments.
So if you're a company, you're automatically defined as a large landlord. And also a landlord who owns four or more tenancies or a company. So basically, they're the main definition of a large landlord that applies.
They're very restricted.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're very restricted in that they don't have some of the exemptions to do with hardship that apply to the smaller landlords. And that's because, as we know in Ireland, there are landlords in that smaller landlord category who have bought it as a pension investment or have a relative in a nursing home. So the legislation, in fairness, applies a set of criteria also to that cohort of landlords.
Okay. Thank you for that, Rosemary. That is very, very clear, although complex, because it is a complex piece of kit. So we would say to any tenants or landlords who are kind of navigating the way through this that the RTB has plenty of resources on its website, rtb.ie, where you can find all of that and more. Brian Galway, let me talk to you now, because it is the case, and we heard on the news that during the week that the RTB has revealed that it received 5,207 notices of termination in the fourth quarter of 2025. Now, this is because landlords have to notify you when they are getting rid of a tenant or offering a notice of termination, okay? Sending one. What made this notable, it was that it was a rise of 41% over the previous year, but that 6 out of 10 of them said it's because we're selling up. Now, are you able to link them selling up with these new rules? Because it would seem inescapable that increase is due to that.
So the information that we published this week related to Q4, so it's prior to the introduction of
these
new
rules. They knew it was coming though, Brian.
I know, but what we would like to point to is the overall size and shape of the sector and how that is evolving. So the overall number of tenancies on the RTB register at the end of last year was up to 339,000, which is the highest since this data series began. We've also seen an increase specifically in private tenancies. We've also seen an increase in student-specific accommodation tenancies and an increase in approved housing body tenancies, which increased by over 11% year on year.
Yeah, now, just to be clear, the student and the approved housing body doesn't come in under these particular new... Okay. Let's look at, you know, what we actually know about the smaller landlords, now defined as three properties or less. And there's a chunk of them now selling up because there's presumably saying, these are my words, not yours, because I know you don't keep tabs on it, but this, you know, this is going to come down the line. It's going to impact me. I'm getting out of the market.
Yeah, so in 2023, we published research where we spoke to small landlords in the sector. And at that point in time, about a quarter of them indicated they did plan to leave the sector within the next 5 years. So while it is quite a high number that have indicated they're ending the tenancy, it's not necessarily unsurprising. We were expecting some of these small landlords to end the tenancy. We know that a lot of small landlords are what some might term an accidental landlord, meaning they acquired the property without actually without intending to become a landlord initially. So they might have lived in it themselves, or they might have inherited it and then
bought it during the Celtic Tiger.
Absolutely.
Lost it.
And some of those landlords now, you know, are intending to leave the sector. But we did know from our research previously that was going to happen. But we've always seen landlords come and go from the sector. Mm. So if we look to the overall number of tenancies in the sector, I think that's a key indicator of what's happening there. And we saw this particular quarter that the number of tenancies on the register, the number of private tenancies specifically, rose to over 243,000.
Okay. So these are people entering the market in mindful of these new rules, who have chosen to buy one or two properties or apartments to enter the market. Is that
correct? Yeah, just to be clear, that the date I'm talking about is the end of 2025, but obviously the rules would have been announced by that time, so they would have been aware of it.
Okay, so it's a movable force, you know, people in, people out, tenants in, tenants out, it happens all the time. If you are a tenant right now, to anybody listening to The Home Show right now who is in a flat or an apartment under the old rules, they're there a year, it took them ages to find it, they're barely affording it, should they be worried now, more worried that their landlord could come to them and say, do you know what, this is too much for me, I can't be bothered, I'm out?
I don't necessarily think they should be more worried. I think, you know, we generally see between 4,000 to 5,000 notices of termination every quarter since this data series began. So while we have seen an increase, the increase isn't necessarily as stark as you might suggest.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, time will tell,
absolutely,
I suppose,
yeah,
and bear this out. Rosemary, I wrote a piece in the Irish Independent a number of weeks ago on this very topic and, you know, what these new rules might mean. And I'm wondering whether the government is in fact trying to solve an entirely different problem. So it would be my contention that, in fact, they don't want all the amateur landlords in the market. We are an outlier in Europe. It is not the model that pertains in Berlin and Paris and Amsterdam and places like that. And in fact, there is a push and a favouritism now towards the institutional landlords. If that is so, and maybe you'll profoundly disagree with me, is this going to aid that end goal, do you think?
I think, in fairness to the government, what they're trying to do is bring consistency to the sector. And I think, as we've seen over the past 2 weeks, you know, a number of tenants who've been served NOTs, it's a very distressing situation for those tenants. And so what I think they're giving a signal to is that they want a consistency of presence with the tenancies and minimum duration. And I think this goes back to a discussion that we had before about being a landlord is a professional job. Mm. You are committing to providing somebody with their home. You're expecting, and they have rights in regard to what the duties of the tenant are also in that relationship. And I suppose what the government is saying is we want everybody to engage with and support these rules and operate them consistently. And that's why we now write to any tenant who has received a notice of termination and allow them or advise them that they can then bring a dispute to the RTB within 90 days. And it's our role as a regulator to ensure that both tenants and landlords respect these rules. Mm. And we want to reduce as much as possible churn in the market,
yeah,
because people need a home
and
for a certain period of time.
And the uncertainty, as you said.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to this issue as well of people being reasonable on both the landlord and tenant side. What we're driving towards is a framework which gives more rights to both in terms of the expectations that are placed on them. But we need to be also very clear that it's not a free-for-all. You know, people can't just, you know, disobey the rules.
You're out, you're in,
or take
the
law into their own hand.
Okay.
And I've been very clear about that, Sinead, in all the briefings that we've been doing with stakeholders.
Okay. And then just a final question, because we got in from a listener about a multi-let tenant. So, you know, I think a lot of tenancies, people think, oh, it's a family. They're either in before March or they're not in before March. But you might have workmates sharing a house that's let. Some of them are there since before March. Another one comes in after March. Are they going to enjoy a different set of rules? Does the property get split in half or what happens?
So the best thing that a tenant in that situation can do is take out the lease agreement. If the tenancy has been reassigned to a new tenant with the landlord's consent, then they acquire the Part 4 rules that apply to that original tenancy. They don't become a new tenancy under the post-March rules because the original lease applies. It's also important that the RTB, we treat these registrations as one registration, so there's only one dwelling that can be registered with the RTB.
So it's not going to be handbags in the living room with one
not
tenant getting longer.
But if
than
you
the
do
other.
Need to get your handbag out, what I suggest you do is go to the RTB website and just look at the advice there and talk to your landlord. Like, we're seeing from the dispute services, a lot of these disputes are actually resolved through talking and mediation services.
All right, which you offer very, very well indeed, and I know people are happy with that. Okay, well, listen, thank you for bringing us up to date. As I say, time will tell on what happens and how it all pans out, and if it does what it says on the tin. It has been an uncertain time, for sure, and I suppose there's a little bit of catch up to do for everybody, tenants and landlords, and for your part in it as well. You have aided that. Rosemary Steen, Head of the Residential Tenancies Board, and Brian Galway, Senior Research Manager. Thank you for joining us on The Home Show.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, today we finish our series on architecture through the ages with architect Roisin Murphy. So it's fitting that she is bringing us now into the modern era as we look at a period called... Welcome, Roisin. What are we calling this period?
I suppose it's the early modernism, international style.
Yeah.
It was the, you know, the modernism goes through two or three manifestations, postmodernism and all, and late stage modernism or late stage capitalism. But yeah.
So can we start with the property then? Because we're in the mid-century, mid-20th century Ireland, pretty much, or coming up to it.
Yeah.
The type of property that I think most of us associate with this period, or at least are familiar with ourselves, is probably the estate house.
Yeah. And go on, explain.
You know, like these 3-4-bed semi-detached homes in suburbs that were built in the 50s, the 60s, and being kind of, that are still now kind of commanding high prices. Mm. They were well built and they were built to a formula.
You see, I associated with white stucco Michael Scott houses, Eilingre. I associate this period with, there's a certain type of house. There's two people, there's three, Scott, Gray and Sims. They're the three people I associate modernism in Ireland with, right? That stucco, flat-roofed house with the big window, it completely changed. And also sort of the likes of Marino, the first free state housing estates.
Yes.
Okay, so, and I also associated with a really sad part of the kind of history of architecture in the city where we based, there was a lot of slum clearances at the same time.
Yes.
Hence what you're correctly identifying as the growth of those suburban estate houses. But that we saw the end of the city living. Like we just became, we, you know, those plastered houses, where do you think about them? When you think of Michael Scott and the white plastered house, where do you think?
There's quite a lot of them out Dunleary Way.
Exactly.
And then there's some around the Terenure, kind of, there was an attempt at them around the Rathmines and Terenure area.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are, there's no doubt they're beautiful. They very possibly belong in a sun-soaked beach somewhere on the west coast of America.
Well, you can blame a fella called Le Corbusier for that. Le Corbusier, Eileen Gray, and another fella who I'm not even going to pronounce, all came together to write this kind of, the five principles of modern architecture, and was the thing called free plan columns. Columns said in the Kildare accent, columns, and kind of large windows.
Yes.
But the thing about it is, at that stage, they were designed for, and roof terraces, they were, the principle of that came from the south of France, where Eileen Gray has her really famous E10 37 house. And it didn't transfer to the damp, cold, very windy, very exposed areas of Ireland. Okay, so, but at the same extent, it did bring something into the Irish psyche about, I don't know, like the glamour of modernism. And I think also the thing about modernism that's so wonderful, okay, so there's a lot of negs on it, but the wonderful thing about it was it didn't refer back to past periods of history. You know, the way we've gone through the Edwardian period, Art Deco, all of those refer back to either a period of time like Gothic architecture revival for the Edwardian period, for the Victorian period, and then Edwardian was another revival, and then we saw English Renaissance. We've seen, everybody was looking back to the past. Mm. Modernism was all about the idea of standardization of design as well. We had our first set of kind of architectural standards were produced by a guy called Neufert. And anybody who is a deep dive geek, go to Neufert, N-E-U-F-E-R-T. He produced the first standardized set of kind of measurements for architecture. And it was done in 1914. And it was also, he was kind of associated with this group called Bauhaus, which is a big kind of school of modernism in the Weimar Republic in Germany. And they really were the proponents of this idea that you could liberate people from the past. And it came with a lot of political theory. Now, it was really enjoyed by the middle classes, but it was also extremely interesting because it was all about this machine aesthetic.
Yeah.
So everything was designed around what it looked like technologically and all, you know, so you see this kind of lack of decoration, very strong expression of factories that you know, and mass production of furniture.
And actually, isn't that the key to all of this? Because up to now, really, everything was bespoke, handmade, collected as special, that you know, that
antique.
You're a little bit above the the hoi polloi,
individualistic.
Yes. Whereas this period now is, because we spoke last time about the burgeoning middle classes coming in, the kind of the mid-war kind of thing, because a lot of the women now were working and they liked it. And they suddenly realized they want to buy stuff.
Yeah.
And they could afford houses in suburbs and all that. So So it's lovely the way you explained it there, that it was suddenly looking forward. There was nothing like it in the past.
And there was the beginning of the... So they had also this extraordinary kitchen that was designed by a woman in one of the big expositions, which building expositions were a big thing. So, and it was... Now, she really came to regret it because it became... She designed it like a lab. The idea was it was a liberating tool, but it was associated... She was the first female architect, and she... really came to regret. Anyway, my big thing I want to say before I'm kicked off for going down too many rabbit holes is there was a guy called Adolf Loos, right, who wrote this incredible, The Crime and Ornamentation, I think was the essay. Some other geek is going to correct me on that. And he was talking about how it was a sin, basically, to have any ornamentation, anything that was decorated at all was a crime, okay? And this became a huge issue in a building he did in Vienna where one was completely stark without any decoration. Now, it was still very much in the proportions of kind of long windows.
Was it that the building was the beauty? You shouldn't be adding bits to it.
It was a moralistic tone. And it followed also with the whole, I think, the draining of colour from architecture. This is my theory anyway. That this, it all became that thing of form follows function and the beloved white architectural interior where anything excessive was considered a sin. So if you, like, it was really moralistic. Right. And they had a big battle about this. But to an extent... their interiors were very expensive. Don't get those guys, they may have done, like Mies van der Rohe, all those guys, they did a lot of really stark, but their interiors were full of marble,
and you can
full
see
of
it
lush.
In the furniture of the time, it was beautiful, but
lush.
Sparse.
Yeah.
You know, there was no kind of carving or tapestries.
Exactly,
or
and very
colour.
Little wood. Yeah. But the thing is, Adolf Loos, if you get a chance, he was this probably one of the most seminal pieces of literature ever written at the beginning of modernism. And it was early, it was before World War II. But the thing, World War I, but the thing about it is that he has a bar in Trinity. Right, there's an actual reproduction of an Adolf Loos bar in Trinity. Now, you could only get to it, I think, either on the open days, or if you become a scull, right?
Okay, yeah.
So I've never been. I mean, I've been to the Buttery Bar and I kept trying to convince the kids, oh, it's the same thing. And they said, no, this bar is extraordinary. So it's a reproduction of his really famous bar. So if you have a friend in Trinity, and the other one that's really interested in is a derelict building. The very first modernist house that was built in Ireland was actually built in Glasnevin. It's the old fisheries building. Now it's derelict and it's really easy to get to, but it had wings like an airplane as well. So if you get a chance, get a look at it. Braemar House.
So I suppose once we get past, you know, the really avant-garde stuff, Roisin, that people were doing for corporate buildings or for beautiful houses. You mentioned one figure earlier on there who was absolutely key to what was happening in a lower demographic, the ordinary people, and this was Herbert Sims.
Herbert Sims.
Now, we had Ono Brin in a few weeks ago because he's written a book on Herbert Sims.
Yeah.
And it's fab and
book.
It looks gorgeous and the pictures are absolutely fabulous. But remind us, this modern period was all about a burgeoning population.
Yeah.
And the spend that was needed to house them.
I know. And the thing about, I think about Herbert Sims, one of the really interesting things about him is that he was influenced by two styles. He was influenced by mainland continent and also Britain. He was British. He was a working class kid who was qualified as an architect. And I think that is what gave him that sensitivity about architecture. So he had unusually... all of those apartments were entered from the street in Britain. But he, as Ono Brin has probably said, our apartment blocks got entered in through the back. So he had this kind of collective courtyard system, which you'll see all the time in the likes of Vienna and Denmark and all those places. But the slum clearance job, the identification of slums in Ireland was really interesting because even we have a huge legacy and a huge loss because of it. I mean, you're talking about tranches of really pivotal and important Georgian architecture. And they argue now that it was allowed to fall down so they could clear it. So what he was doing, Herbert Sims, was building apartment blocks in the place of where, before they cleared the slums, housing the people so they could stay in their location. And then they would build another apartment block.
No retrofitting back there.
No,
get rid.
Get rid. And then yeah. The thing is that it kept people in their locale. So the idea was that this city living became part, it was part of his legacy. But you see these beautiful four-story curved end buildings with brick, kind of upright brick details. Even particularly the one, my favourite one is the one opposite the forecourts. If you go around that bend, that used to be up towards the abused, now gone motor tax office, now a hotel. There's just a series there, and they're so lovely because the way it moved, he was very delicate. He had a real delicacy. Yeah. Also, his work along the coast where he did the shelters for swimming, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But he also did an awful lot of the suburban houses, and apparently he hated that. That's the story, because he really was an urban regeneration.
Indeed. It. And I think Owen, when he was in here, brought up that it was like, because now they had him. And they recognised his worth. They just shoveled him onto every single project that came up, and it was literally the death of him.
It was. He had that, I think. And I would say this in terms of architecture, because the shocking thing about architecture, if you work in the practice, is how intensely difficult, laborious and physical it is. Mm. It seems like a very nice thing, and they're always characterised by these sensitive people who go off with roundy glasses and have a great life, and that's just the girls. That is not what it's like. Even the very famous Zaha Hadid, the Iranian female architect who did The Edge and everything, deconstructivist architect, she said after her 110th gold medal, I still have to get up in the morning and deal with 6 months of legal issues.
Yeah.
Our very famous McLaughlin architect, who got, I think he got some huge award in Britain recently, he does all of the Cambridge work. He said, I spent 6 months of my year dealing with the legal stuff. Mm. It is a tough gig. Yeah. And so if you're getting all that responsibility, they didn't replace the architect, the city architect. I'm going on a rant, haven't I? It's irrelevant. Okay, architecture is a tough gig. It's incredibly rewarding and satisfying, but it's a tough gig. And Herbert Sims paid for it.
Yeah, he did indeed. He did indeed. All right. Well, listen, that brings to an end. We're not quite up to date because there's been so much building and non-building. But
yeah.
It strikes me from this fabulous series, Roisin, and thank you once again for coming in every single week to do this. It has been fascinating. And by the way, all the other episodes right back to the Georgian period are up on the Home Show podcast, and you can listen to Roisin on all of that. What strikes me, I think most of all, apart from the nostalgia and the beauty of eras gone by, is the fact that, I don't know, I just get the sense that we just used to do things much better. Everything was just done.
You sound
better.
Like Queen Victoria now.
I do.
In the olden days,
and we have so much. We have so many more resources. We have so much more technology, and yet it seems we just can't. We can't do things in the same way. Listen, that's just my age. That's looking back with rose-tinted glasses. Roisin, you've been fantastic. Thanks a million for doing this series.
You're very welcome.
And we will see you again on the Home Show before long. Now, a nationwide series of workshops designed to help DIYers sharpen their skills to trade level is being launched by Chadwicks today, with masterclasses from Declan Buggy, founder of the School of DIY. And Declan joins me now to tell us more. Declan, you're on the road. You're very welcome to the Home Show. Now, tell us a little bit about these workshops. They're not aimed at the complete beginner like me.
No, so they're kind of aimed at the middle of the road person. Now, don't get me wrong, we won't leave someone behind if they are a bit of a beginner, but we will also kind of try aim it at people looking at maybe renovating their house or doing a little bit of a step up from when your traditional, say, hang shelves or hang pictures.
Right, okay. I can hang pictures, so that's probably a good start for me, and paint a wall. So what kind of skills are we talking about?
So we're looking at all different types of things. So each class is going to be kind of based around a different sort of a skill. So our first one is around plasterboard and different types of plasterboard we'll use around the place inside the house. So our internal walls, we'll look at how to repair walls, how to patch walls, how to cut out some plasterboard and put in new plasterboard, as well as different types of plasterboard. So our fire rated board, where we'd use that, and where we'd use a regular standard plasterboard and our insulated slabs. So all the first road show as such in the Robin Hood Road on the 26th is based around our plasterboard and internal walls.
Right. So that's not for the faint-hearted now. And will you have at these, and they're being held in different places around the country, isn't that right?
That's correct, yeah, and different ones. So the first one, like we said, is plasterboard. The second one might be plumbing, might be whatever, so on and so on. So there'll be different topics for each one.
Okay. Now, when it comes to skills like that, I mean, why do you think this is important for people to learn? Because I suppose that, you know, there are some jobs that you definitely need the experts in for. You shouldn't be tackling yourself, but there's also lots of people who would be considered very, very handy.
Absolutely. I think it's now more important than ever in the way that if you ring any tradesman and they're entitled to it as well, if you call them just to come out to your house, it's now 90 to 100 euro for a call out fee for someone just to turn up for 5 minutes. And it's the case of that there's a massive lack of tradespeople. So it's about time we all learned how to do these things. Years ago, they all knew how to do these things, or at least one person per household knew how to do these things. Now we feel that there's just a massive bridge there, a gap that we need to bridge, just to get people hands-on, learn how to use their tools and do these simple tasks.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about people who used to be able to do these things, why do you think that's changed so much? I mean, I know my grandfather and indeed my father would have been absolutely thought nothing about, you know, fixing a wall, shoring up a leak, you know, plumbing in a washing machine. Like that stuff, they were well able to do. In my grandfather's case, he built furniture as a hobby. Have we lost something along the years, do you think, Declan, that it's not considered?
Mine was the very same. My granddad was a furniture builder as well, so he was. I feel like they have now, things have gone far more technical and advanced as well, in terms of like, you can't just take apart a kettle now and fix a piece of it, unfortunately. Things are made to not be taken apart. But there is still plenty of things to be able to be fixed. Like, why couldn't we re-glue the chair and fix the chair? Why can't we redo these types of things? Simple tasks. And why can't we just learn how to do these things ourselves? My way of looking at it is, there's far thicker fellas than I can do it, so why can't I figure it out? You know, that's always my approach to everything. Is I'm smarter than that fellow over there, I feel. Why can't I figure that out? He can do it, I can do it.
Isn't there a confidence thing about it, though? Because you're faced with, I get that kind of sense of dread every time I go into IKEA. You know, I'm always wondering, are there going to be bits left over if I try to assemble something and put it together, and wondering then, is it not quite right, or where have I got wrong? And it can all seem very complicated, like an adult Meccano set.
I always feel like the one I always go to is, it's very easy for people to see it on TikTok and stuff like that of how to do this, and they're showing step 6, 7 and 8, and they don't know how to put a bit into a drill, so they're missing step 1 and step 2, and all of a sudden step 6, 7 and 8 feel like miles away. But if you can show them these tiny little skills for step 1 and 2, just things you have to be shown, you can't, unless you spend a couple of hours at it, you won't figure out these things, you know. So if you're just showing these small little tips and tricks, that step 6, 7, 8 becomes very simple, and you'll find that step 6, 7, 8, so on, is the very same on this project as that project as the other project. They're all just small skills repeated over and over again.
Yeah, and isn't that the trick to everything? It's a bit like, you don't start cooking with the souffle, you start to boil an egg, don't you?
Exactly.
So you have to learn the basics. All right. So what are the most common mistakes then that people make at home when they try to tackle a project? They say, do you know what, this doesn't look too hard. It's going to cost me 500 quid to get somebody in to do it. I'll do it myself. Maybe fix a fence or put back together a chair or something like that.
I think it's the little theory bits and pieces. So when I say theory, I mean like very simple things. You go into a hardware shop. I think hardware shops can be one of the most intimidating places in the world for people. You walk into any hardware shop, and in fairness, they have got better in terms of, they will help you and they'll talk you through it. But if you're going in to buy, I know I need a rod plug, I know I need a drill bit to go into the wall, and then you go in to buy it and you go, oh, Jesus, I don't know if I need a masonry bit, a timber bit, a metal bit. I don't know what thickness the bit should be, and I don't know what thickness the rod plug should be. So instead of Now you're after buying an 8mm drill bit and you have a 6mm rod plug. You drill the 8mm hole in it and the rod plug falls out of the hole. Mm. And you go, oh Lord, what am I after doing? So then we'll call the man or call someone around to fix it.
Exactly. What we used to call, that was what the Golden Pages was for. Anybody who can remember the Golden Pages from 100 years ago. Right. Okay. Well, listen, this obviously sounds like something that people should give a go to. I think we are all buying into the whole kind of repair, reuse, recycle kind of message, especially since the COVID years. So it's a great thing to be doing. You have Chadwicks on board. And as you say, the first one is in Chadwicks, the Robin Hood branch in Dublin on Thursday, the 26th of March. And that's internal walls and structures, a drilling masterclass. There you go. We'll learn all about the masonry bits there. And there are a range of them around the country. Tickets are available from chadwicks.ie/tricksofthetrade.ie. And Declan Buggy, founder of the School of DIY. Thanks a million. And the very best of luck with all those nearly amateurs.
The Home Show on News Talk. The Home Show on News Talk.
Now, getting in an interior designer can be an expensive thing to do, especially if you haven't yet committed to a specific project or you haven't a clue what it is you want to do. So you won't be surprised to hear there's an app for that. Here to tell us more about his experience using an AI designer is Paul Kinsella, Home Show regular. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you, thank you.
Now, this is, to me, kind of bordering on slightly terrifying.
I find it revolutionary now.
I know. Do you know what? I'm going to say that's a generational thing.
Yeah, okay.
Look, it is fantastic, no question. And I'm tempering it with seeing a video of, you know, Trump dancing with Putin and wondering, is that real or fake?
Yeah,
do you know?
Yeah,
And you have to kind of manage off the good bits of AI and the bits that are really worrying with AI. But this is a phenomenal development.
And to your point, it's for the people. It's not going to replace an interior designer. That is not what this is about. This is about showing people some possibility in their home. And that's what I love, because my husband loves to see things. He has to see it before I can make it happen in the house.
Yeah.
So by giving him a visual like this, it really shows him what the vision is, because he just can't see it, even though I can see it in five different ways in my head.
And I would have thought in your household, Paul, you were like, Mark will be fine. Just trust me.
No. he says that after it's happened and after we've had hours of debate over it. But no, he still has an opinion on the house, I will say.
Okay, all right.
Much to my disgust, but hey ho.
Okay, so let's start with what it is and what it does, because this isn't just AI. We're talking about specific apps here that exist.
So where I use at the minute for like a quick fix is I use ChatGPT, or I use Copilot, or I use Google Gemini. They're all the same kind of information AI app. And what you would have seen, and I'll share it today, I actually did it for my garden. I recently had to get rid of the grass because the soil wasn't draining properly. There was not enough clay. There's too much clay in the soil. Anyway, long story short, I got 3 samples of paving slab, and I took 3 pictures of the paving slab, and I said, render this into my garden using a slab that's 2x1. And it did it for me in 3 different colours, and it gave me a really clear option of what the garden could look like, and it helped me decide.
Okay, so for the uninitiated, practically and physically, how do you do that?
Perfect. So I'm going to get you to, you'll open up your ChatGPT or your Copilot or your Google. Every phone will have one of them naturally. Mm. And take a picture straight away of a corner that you like. And then you're going to use a prompt like, take this photo and redesign it to make it feel more modern and cozy. But don't make it unrealistic. And then they will start to generate. Now, that's if you don't have an idea. If you have an idea, you can be a bit more specific. So I, with the garden, would have said, this is my back garden. I need you now to take this slab. And I would take a second picture. And I said, put the slab down on in the garden in replacing of the grass. And it would do it for me.
It's a bit
scary, but also it's great, because it just gives you a really quick guideline as to what it is without costing. So you're not going in and going with massive cost. Mm. You can do this with paint colours. You can do this with pieces of furniture. So you can actually link a couch that you like in maybe Easy Living Interiors. You can pop it in and say, take this couch and pop it into my space. And they'll do it for you.
Okay. So like how much, we'll get onto the particular apps now in a minute, which ones work the best. But how much tech savvy do you need?
Well, I mean, if you wanted, we could do it right now. We could take a picture of the studio and we could just say, make our studio more modern. It's that easy. It's literally taking a picture and say, help me make this more modern. I like blue. Make me a blue living room.
Right. Okay.
It's free. And then you can get more in depth. If you want to get more in depth, you can give it feedback on what it's given you. So actually, I don't like that shade of blue. I like this shade of blue.
So you can get it to redo it.
So you can get it to redo it.
Now, okay. So it strikes me then, okay, that sounds amazing. So you take a photograph of, you know, a particular part of your house or kitchen or hallway or whatever it is and say, I render this for me in hot pink.
Hot pink.
With a green carpet.
Beautiful colour combination.
Yeah, the whole barbacore was so loud 2 years ago. And it comes back with its imagining of that. Now, on the ones I've seen, now, I haven't used this, but on the ones I've seen coming through my feed, because obviously I've been Googling a bit about this. So the algorithm has gone, hey, potential customer here. And it's pushing these design AI apps into
my
feed.
Of course.
And what I've noticed from the before and after that it's showing me, that it's punching me, the after, sometimes it's replaced all the windows, it's put up a brand new fence, it's put in a new, it's like, it's about like 50 grand's worth of change rather than the 500 that I have.
Well, it does depend. So that's where the, so for me, I would use a quick render with ChatGPT or Google Gemini. Because if you go into that room analyzer AI builder, it will really put in the 50 grand.
Okay.
Whereas if you just want a quick fix or an idea of something, I'd say the basic app of ChatGPT or Google Gemini will do it for you.
Okay, all right. Now, give us an idea of the different types of ones that you're familiar with. And of course, is there a cost implication here, Paul? Because we know that like ChatGPT, I have the basic version of that.
Of course.
I haven't really got to grips with it. Yeah. It hasn't ever done anything that I've gone, wow, yet.
Yeah.
But that's down to me probably rather than it. I have the free version.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the different type of ones. So you've mentioned ChatGPT, Gemini, because they're the ones that pop up whether you like it or not.
Yeah, whether you like it or not. Now, if we want more complex, you've got something like Room Styler, which will do what you're saying, where it might redo the windows and it might redo the door and the wall, and depending on, so there will be more cost to it. But again, that is a paid and a basic version. So most of these apps nowadays have a basic version, and you'll get like two or three goes for free, and then you'll get a subscription fee. But also, a lot of them have a subscription fee. That's a very hard word to say. And it has a trial. So you'll do it for a 7-day trial and then you can cancel it.
Okay.
So if you're just looking for one particular small project, you could sign up for the trial and then cancel it and get your room on the premium.
Do they get a bit addictive though?
You just have to be very methodical and good at cancelling subscriptions. Okay, I'm very good. Right. So I'm thrifty.
Do you end up going like, okay, I've done the haul now. Oh, I might give it a sitting room.
Time.
I might give
Mark
it a bath.
Mark is like, you need to stop it.
Step away.
So
from
I have the garden, I have our back room, and I have my office at the minute all on the go. And he's like, you need to stop it. But another good one now, it's a little bit more advanced, I'd say, because it's actually good for people if they are probably in a build or they're looking to build a house because it's called 5D Planner. And what that does is it's a bit like The Sims. You can build your wall, you can put in a unit, you can put in a bed.
Oh, like architectural drawings.
Like architectural drawings, but a very basic now. Again, we're not coming for the architects. But again, there's a basic package that you can do kind of a generalization with, and then the premium, which is, I think, I would do a consultation if we're doing a room for somebody and a makeover where I'd give them a shopping list. I'd kind of give them a render of the room with the pieces I suggest, shall we say. And then another really good one for people if they're just looking for a paint colour is Dulux Visualizer, completely free. And it's where they download an app and you open up your camera and you can see the colour in the Dulux colour house on the walls.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you stand in your room, you take a photograph of your living room and then say, put this in Dulux colour, whatever.
Ballet pump, and it'll put it in the pink ballet pump on the walls. Now, again, I would just say err on the side of caution. It will never be as good as a tester. A tester is much better to put on your wall.
Yeah, because you've got a light issue. Different walls at different lights, especially north facing, south facing, all that kind of stuff.
So it'll give you a guide. But again, I find the ChatGPT basic version fine. Open up.
I suppose one of the things that would stop you doing is taking home 20 testers. You might narrow it down to
that
3.
That is the one thing. We need to set up something where we can recycle and give our testers out to somebody else. Because I have about, I would say, no joke, 50 testers in my garage.
I know, but they charge for them now. There used to be a time.
Quite expensive.
You could go in and just pick them off the shelf.
And I do like Alchemist, who's an Irish paint brand. They do peel and stick. So at least they're €1.50 or €2 for a peel and stick. So it's a sticker of the tester and it's very good. I've actually painted the colour over the tester and pulled it off the peel and stick and it's matched perfectly.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So they're really
the innovation.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me then what happened in your case.
Yeah.
You put up these 3 tiles, ground tiles, and you said, show me what this would look like in this space. And it did it.
It did it.
Did you follow its advice?
Yeah, well, it gave me 3 options and I asked the public to help me decide on an option.
Oh, you see,
and then
you need them all.
What I did do is it gave me a pink wall, would you believe, on the back wall. And I really
unasked,
liked it.
Unasked.
Give me out free unsolicited advice. But it gave a lovely pink hue on a back wall and I actually love it. So now I'm going to do it. In my garden.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to give it a go and I'm going to see what it comes up with. And fingers crossed, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe it'll be terrible. Paul Kinsler, that is absolutely fantastic. Now you can catch up on Paul's project, his garden project, and the one we were supposed to talk about today, the pantry. We'll do that the next time. On Life at Number 2, which is his Instagram handle. And it's always very stylish and fabulous.
Thanks.
And I was going to say he makes mistakes so you don't have to, but he never makes mistakes.
Oh, I do. Sometimes I don't record them and put them out.
All right. And that's all we have time for this week on the Home Show podcast. I hope you enjoyed those different elements and learn something from them. If you'd like to get in touch with us, it's thehomeshow@newstalk.com and you'll find me on Insta and X. I'm there usually pottering around online during the week. So happy to chat to you then. And of course, all episodes are up on the podcast on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your pods. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. We'll be back here for next episode next week and we look forward to your company then.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday at 5 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.